instructions like that. It's just like, oh no. Can I just say, I know everybody, can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
I know everybody when they go somewhere, they go, oh, it's really nice to be here, it's lovely, it's great, thanks for having me. But I'm afraid I really mean it. The reason being is my dad is a court man and he was born and bred over the road. And he, this used to be one of his local pubs. And when I told him I was coming here, he said, you've got to see the table. It wasn't a case of well done, Bern, off you go enjoy yourself. I just had to go and see the table, which I've done. If I'm talking too fast, you've got to tell me. Okay, I'm going to start off. Believe it or not, yeah, I got placed in the slam, even though I actually was old enough to be everybody's mother. It's the truth, isn't it? Right, yeah, it's the truth. I just made a joke and I said I was on my way to the bingo and ended up here, and this is all about. So, I'm just going to do a poem that I did in the slam, just to show you that I don't... And then we're going to do something else, right? It's just called Jack's Calf, and it's a taste of Brighton, where I now live. These calves aren't new to anybody, we all know them. I'm sitting in Jack's Calf, snug in the hum of overheard conversation. I'm drinking powdered coffee from the Spice Girls mug and I'm watching the world go round, backwards. Condensation looks like the windows are sweating. Outside, the high street is fizzing as a maze of undone top buttons escape another day of beige decor and air conditioning. And I'm sitting, waiting, watching the oblivious waitress, waiting for a spam-coloured crop top who's counting out a fat fist of copper onto red formica to save her breaking into her last fiver. In the corner, huddled behind the door, a peroxide gang of cheap makeup pull adolescents out of shape. They're flirting with well-thumbed cosmopolitans and dreaming of being fondled in places they haven't found for themselves yet. Opposite, an animal rights activist hides behind a rash of badges, scoffing veggie breakfast fried in sarcastic lard. The waitress screams. She watches me. She knows I'm watching him and we both know what he's doing. He's undressing the giggling skirts, frying slices of their pale thighs in his eyes, and that's naughty. Next to the loo, another too young high-heeled mum rams a screaming pram and over-budget shopping bag smack into the ankles of a silver-spooned future, tarnished by a father who left his quick signature in her knickers after dark party. Behind me, a nest of students bunched like terrorists around salt and pepper pots and plan another bloody revolution. They're trying to get their heads around Marxism as dictated yesterday by a jaded text that can't convince its own argument anymore. And there's a squawk of prepubescence pulling pocket money into the belly of a tea-stained saucer that buy milkshake to give their age away. I watch them suck synthetic strawberries through striped plastic and flash a B&H snatch from some mum's handbag, with bad habits having its collar felt. In the window seat, a brood of navvies with broad Dublin accents fill their crusty Doc Martens with full English breakfast, and I think of the famine in Jack's Calf. Snug in the hum of overheard conversation, I'm drinking powdered coffee from a Spice Girls mug and I'm watching the world go round and round backwards. Actually what poetry is, and I guess for me it's just kind of getting the essence of something. This poem's called Nowness. Why did I invite myself to this town I can't spell? A cheap hotel room with old soap and psychedelic curtains. Tried to convince myself it would mend me, pretend I'll write poetry, diet, lose a few pounds, then return to Brighton with a suspicious glow. No, I'm just as lost on this prettier beach, watching the horizon slackline and the tide can't slip. But I watch a blind child eat an ice cream and try to arrest nowness, threaten the weather, Take a deep breath and review and argue with postcards. And try to unravel the scribble of gold above as they swoon in and out of each other's shadows, failing to form love. The next one. I seem to write about hotels. Yes, a lot of research. Oh, you like hotels? Well, right on.
No, that was for the previous point.
Oh, thank you! Wait till you're in each one. Hotels, right. I won't explain every poem. These are a bunch of poems about hotels and people who go to hotels and what goes on. As I say, let's just do them together in a bunch. This one's called Hotel. We meet in room 101 at the same time every week. The ensuite is a scream of lemon and lime tiles. The toilet, a terrified white. You cling to nicotine, blow the smoke rings, ochre halos in my hair. As we fumble, speak like clumsy cousins, and the mirror glares at our unstitched sex. Watching us fail to fake ourselves in this 100 square feet of wood chip and veneer, where creases gossip in off-white cotton, and our awkward shadow crawls backwards up the wall. This is a poem about a man who I have no idea who he is, but he likes to go to Berlin for some reason, and he just happened to fit quite nicely into this bonnet. Called Kaiser, actually, and it's for, I wrote this kind of for in a way Michael Donahue, who was my mentor for a short period of time, he said, oh, wait a minute, his name, Kaiser Sterling. Heat has kidnapped the attic, vindictive. Janice Joplin is bouncing off the wall. His eyes close as he waits for the needle. The back slips that chorus in scratched vinyl. Make me feel like a natural woman. Make me feel like a natural woman. Lyrics that drag you back to Jane's bedsit, her widow's lingerie, chintz print. Standing on the balcony, he throws 3 wishes at tarmac. He hopes she's been blinded by an accident, that her sleep aches and he still stains her sheets. He needs these mangled hotel rooms now, raw prayer, and the stubborn view of Berlin simmering. This next poem, it is actually the title of the first book. It's okay, I do believe you're still out there, you don't have to let me know that I've done one. This is actually a poem that I wrote for a friend of mine. She was a mistress for 40 years. Not a school mistress, someone said that. I really did. And I just quickly tell you, she was a lovely lady, I did love her, and she said to me, she's very English and very posh, and she said, darling, you must always remember to wear a bra in bed. She said, well, it's breast muscles, darling, they fall, and I'm like, okay, Pamela, yeah, right on. And then she said, unless, of course, you're entertaining. It's a very sweet thing, isn't it? Oh, bless her heart. So I wrote, this is kind of for her, really. It's called, just called Perfect Mess. They met at a party where surnames were not invited. Neither had expected this tender accident. Now they meet in alibis, to pool their egos and unfold love's dark arts like a ballerina's spine. In a room with green muslin curtains, where their secret lies under the bed. They are the perfect mess, helpless as ice in vodka, polluted yet beautiful, petrol and water. I'll say one that's in the new collection because it's a bit naughty. I'll see how you feel later on.
Or how I feel.
This I'm going to do because it's raised contentions and it's raised very different attitudes to come back off this one, so we'll go to it anyway. Everybody knows, heard of the band Joy Division?
Yeah.
Good, thanks for the bit, not quite so old.
Excellent.
It's called Growing Pains and hopefully it'll speak for itself. Silence was the lullaby you left to keep Susan awake. She wasted her teenage looking for the reason she said must be hidden in your record collection. She untangled Joy Division, two-tone and scar, till anorexia finally broke her. She unstitched each lyric, gnawed every chorus and verse, punished herself like a thin dog. Because you gave her the red thing that any glass shape could cut out of a wrist. And I hope you had time to panic properly. Time to regret the mess you left for your mother to find. I hope you had time to watch your soft pulse throb like love steps into the bath you drew like a Hollywood cliche. Yes. I hope you had time to panic properly. See, I'll just remember you as the one with fat finger that Susan even bothered to kiss. The pseudo-local hero hungry girls fell in love with till their period started. But I never will forget your dad in my dad's chair drinking whiskey, asking me to write your eulogy because I liked poetry and wouldn't let him down. So it was for him and him alone I took that red, filthy drug at your funeral, so that I was capable to stand at the altar to tell lies to your mother, to a too young congregation that stood in their older brother's suits, smart shoes and awkward black ties. I watched them cast aimless prayers into the sky while I begged God for a selfish frost to chew the football pitch you ran across every fucking Sunday. I hope you have time to panic properly. Oh. It's quite funny actually because I've said to you all, but I actually think it's a responsibility of things artful sometimes to grab things by the neck. Do you know what I mean? Not to slap them in people's faces, but at least to kind of get them out there. This is another one. From when I was a teenager, and anorexia and glue sniffing were all the rage. That was a joke. In your own song. Yeah. And I did call. My first little crush boy was skinhead, and that's fine. And I'm sure they're going to and it's called Kingpin. He was God. Ox blood, 18 hole steel toe cap Doc Martens. Skin fit, bleached jeans, Ben Sherman, khaki Harrington. He was suede shaven. A flea run running temporal to neck. An Indian ink cut here tattoo across his neck. He had a silver ring in his top lip, a chipped front tooth. He was a cocky fuck. The handsome king in a gang of scrambled lads that crashed round the garages, getting wasted on Thunderbird, cider, spliff and glue. He used to sniff until he tasted blood, till his shadow started arguing back and backwards, with his broken head pressed against an untuned radio, moaning two tones into one note. I kissed him once at Steve's 18th, out of my tree on Benelin and Sherry. He cracked my lipstick, his relentless erection pressed against my left thigh. He tasted like a deep breath in my father's shed, or the sixth form art room where my lovesick compass engraved his name on their desk. Because I loved him in spite of good advice, because he dared me to let him. stare into my eyes. For interesting reasons, I spent 6 months in hospital, some of which, about three of them were in rehab, which sounds very trendy, but it wasn't actually drug rehab, it wasn't anything sexy, or in Vogue or whatever. It was due to, it was basically a rehab unit for people who had strokes, back injuries, etc, etc. I spent 3 months in there, 6 months in total in hospital. So I'm just going to do a few, if I may, about that time in hospital. The first one is called Circus. The ward nap, then a bank nurse with eyes sweet as sherry pours sugary tea into a plastic beaker with a lid for me because I can't grip the heavy liquid that punctuates the day. This place within me. Half-baked faces, spilt profiles, contorted jawbones like plasticine in warm hands. Arms hang at impossible angles off starched pillows, legs slung comfortably as jackstraws under the same tables as every day. We are cutlery drawers, upturned into wheelchairs, fed grapes by speechless hands. The circus of wounded animals, teetering on the edge, like barflies on two high stools. Obviously, while I was in there, I met some people, lots of people. This is a little poem I wrote for. It's actually Anthony and Rose, that was their name. Rose visits Tony every evening after work, chit-chats to the all too familiar ward staff, and sits in the polite day room while a pastel uniform wheels him in. Tony sits opposite, drools, grunts like selfish sex, and the charade begins. She minds her day unconvincingly while he stares into somewhere else. They don't talk much with the stroke at his tongue out, bursts his head like a black and red feathered pillow, leaving love to struggle to choking fish. I won't do any more of them. I'll now go on to women who've lost their men. How much longer have I got? I'll do a few of these women who've lost their blokes for one reason or another. No, they're not all sad about it. First one's for the key. We sat on the wrong side of sympathy. As Dr. Scott's manicured words outlined the shadow that had crawled around your lung like spiked ivy since last autumn. For the last time we sat facing that painting that hung in her consulting room, mountain, oil on canvas, abstract, signed by a contrived hand, underlined. For a moment, truth made the view bigger. Outside, London was still happening. Red, amber, green. Brixton was planning its peak. You fussed with your cuff like a truant, as the diagnosis was disguised in plain English for us to take home to the kids like a gift wrap grenade. Forever gracious, you offer to drive, knowing I am petrified of twilight. We sat gridlocked. Then, as if it didn't matter, you leant forward, let a violin out of the radio, and I contemplated everything I couldn't know. We pulled into the drive, parked. Chloe's bike was still against the shed where yesterday had left it. Now, where the end begins. I'll start to collect your silhouette. Fingerprints left on glass and plastic. Discarded shadows and leftover profiles and the sketches I will never show you. For the portraits I'll paint, Daisy, oil on canvas, abstract. To hang at that sly angle, only you would understand. I'll see if I see how long it is. Yeah, it's a little story. She's lost her man to prison. Yeah, I'll see what she's done. Okay. Right. And is it Jack on the 9th of every month? Signs her time of arrival in the book. Empties all pockets, the contents of her handbag into a red plastic tray. Signs of security to take custody of all personal effects. Then stands dead straight, while latex fingers frisk her indifferently. She doesn't take suspicion personally like she used to in the old days, when the kids came, before resentment grew up. Just lately she's sad. She's sad Jack hasn't noticed she's trying to stop smoking again. Stops painting her nails coral pink. And hasn't worn a tiny snapshot in the locket of them and candy floss on their two young honeymoons for months. She's sad because leaving him behind glass is getting easier. Glass smudged by lipstick butterflies, left behind by novice wives and tired mothers. She's sad because she no longer believes the same lie he writes on his side. Those awkward misspelt capitals fall backwards through his breath. The apologetic kiss at the end of every sentence. Because she knows now. His promise has less meaning than the deal. In their right mind without this bloody woman. No way. Right, so it's a kind of little thing. I don't know what it is really. Okay. It's a little story. I'm not remembering it. I worked at the Bella Vista Bed and Breakfast. Oh, sorry, about Bed and Breakfast. And the man who runs it is a dirty bastard. And he is, well, for the purpose of this name, should be known as the Greasy Man. Everyone's going, yeah, something like that, yeah, 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 help myself to the messy ice cream that seemed to mix me back, and turned a blind eye to the curious optic and all the mistakes that whiskey makes. The greasy man invited me to Alison, and she drew me like a poultice, seduced me to walk in her soft storm, taught me to trace a lip, an armpit, an incisor in the dark. And sometimes I can still taste that high scarlet slingback in my sleep. Recall the curves she made in that black satin hip-hug skirt that clung like pennant between her legs. Me, Alison, and the dirty, dirty, greasy man play games. We'd make him beg. Then we'd get just drunk enough to hurt for him like warm snow. Then I'd let him rest his head on my inner thigh, just close enough to smell me, while Alison wound his stray nape hairs tight anti-clockwise, and you listen to him cry like a pale child, mourning, damaged. He told you it was sick.